Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to the very first Talkback Gardening of 2024 at the new time of 8 o'clock in the morning. Good morning, John. Happy New Year.
And thank you and very much a happy new year and a prosperous one and a healthy one to our good gardeners. I suspect many gardeners are already outside or maybe have already been outside sprinkling their plants after 2 days of pretty hot weather, and it's going to be pretty warm today with a change coming. But the thing is, we've only had two spikes of heat this summer. In fact, I think there's only 5 days where the temperature got over 30 degrees, which is pretty miserable. And our average temperature for the summer so far is relatively low. And as a result, our plants are looking pretty good. But is the hot spike we're having right now a portent of what we're about to receive? January and February, we've been told, is going to be extremely hot because of El Nino. It's the first Saturday of the month. Darren Ray, climatologist, is going to comment on the fact that why has it been relatively mild when we should be expecting the effects of the El Nino, and there could be other factors influencing El Nino, and poor El Nino looks like is having a hard time. So Darren's going to explain that briefly, and then he's also going to take a look at whether these influences are going to continue, and so instead of that hot, dry summer that we were expecting, maybe it's going to be a little bit milder. Just how much milder and what effect that's going to have during summer is very important from a gardening point of view. Could be we're going to have some great gardening weather coming our way. And Darren also is happy to talk about the chatter that's going on amongst the weather buffs, that El Nino is going to fade quicker than they expected and is going to be replaced with La Nina, the wet one, by winter and maybe spring. So there's a lot of fascinating things going on from a weather, but he'll also drill down and say, righto, in January, February and March, this is what we can expect in terms of rainfall. That'll be interesting.
It sure will.
And also temperatures. Now, very shortly, we're going to take a look at agapanthus. Agapanthus have been flowering, beautiful display this summer, and they are fading now. They're setting seed, and some people are concerned that these seeds will become feral and produce a problem. We're going to talk to
Tracy Coomey.
She runs the agapanthus farm. And it just so happens that the agapanthus farm is one of the open gardens this weekend. So Tracy is going to take a look at what they do with their agapanthus to make sure that they don't have a problem, and what you can do in your own garden. It's all about deadheading. And as I mentioned, later on, we'll talk a little bit about beating the heat.
Wonderful. So much ahead in Talkback Gardening, but the most important element of Talkback Gardening, of course, is you. Call in now on 1300 222 891, 1300 222 891. We also love to get your comments, but John likes to speak to you about your problem and drill down and get to the nub of exactly what's causing the issue for you. But if you'd like to send us a comment through on the text line number is 0467 922 891. And to say Happy New Year to you, I have 3 Organic Gardener magazines, ABC Organic Gardener magazines, to give away a little bit later in the program. 2 of them by phone, 1 of them by text message. So get ready for all of that as well. But call in with your questions, 1300 222 891. Just remember that John's advice is of a general nature and shouldn't be taken as personal professional advice.
This is Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, the rain's already coming. Colin says heavy rain at Wallaroo since 7 o'clock this morning, 9 mils already. So it's coming across the state.
Interesting, yes. So if you're in country areas in particular and you're getting a downpour, let's know, and it'll be interesting to see whether it'll be even rain across the agricultural districts, or will it come as little storm cells? And they're the kind of issues that we don't particularly want.
Well, that's right. It happened in Port Lincoln yesterday, a big drop of about 20 millimetres in a very short space of time.
Yes, and that's going to be very much part of climate change. And I don't think we'll talk that one with Darren Ray. We've got too many other things to talk about.
Yep.
But the formation of those cells, I think, is fascinating.
It sure is. Well, let's go to our first caller this morning. It's Anna from Croydon with a strawberry question. Welcome, Anna, and Happy New Year.
And same to you. Good morning. Yes, I purchased several strawberry plants from a garage sale around about 15 months ago. They've produced lots and lots of runners running all over the garden. Very healthy plants, but no strawberries. Lots of flowers, but no strawberries.
Oh, okay. So they're actually flowering, but they're not actually setting fruit.
No.
Righto. Do you know which variety you planted?
No, okay. I purchased them at a garage sale.
Right,
and they look very healthy. So.
Yes, righto. At plant sales and those kind of areas, you're more likely to get the older-fashioned type of strawberries. Just as a prelude, there are three different types of strawberries. Those that only flower and produce their fruit in springtime with big crops. There are those that have two crops, one in spring, one in autumn. And there's also the latest ones are the ever-bearing. And so they have a crop, they have a little rest, and they keep on cropping throughout the growing season. And that can influence when you get your strawberries. But if they're actually producing flowers, it could be that they're putting on lots of very big dark green leaves and lots of runners?
Yes, very
okay.
healthy.
Right, well, that comes down to nutrition, I think, that the fact that you've got some good soil, you've probably planted them correctly, you've looked after them, and they're saying, righto, well, we'll produce you lots of plant, and they forget about the fact that they've also got to produce the fruit as well. The fact that they're flowering is good, and I would suggest that if you can, get down on hands and knees, and if you want fruit and not particularly runners to produce new plants, then you chop off the runners. As soon as you see a runner form, chop it off, just tip it off. And that means that all the energy which is going into the runners will go into the flower and help set you produce some fruit. Now, in terms of nutrition, stay away from nitrogen fertilizer, and you can either buy, in fact, I'd get a little bit of sulfate of potash. You can actually buy that as a liquid or a powder, but just sprinkle or give the plant a little bit of sulfate of potash. When the plant gets to flowering stage, potash is important in getting flower set and fruit quality.
All right, thank you very much.
Hope it goes well, Anna. Thank you very much for the call. 1-300-222-891 is the number. Off to Mount Gambier now. Heather, you've got some damage to your rose bushes. Good morning.
Good morning, John and Deb, and Happy New Year to you both.
Thank you very much.
Yes, my rose question is, I have one rose in the middle of a whole group that has moth-eaten leaves. It is not flowering anything like the others are. I'm just wondering if you could give me some suggestions.
Right. Oh, well, first of all, we need to drill down and take a look at this moth that eats leaves. Moths, of course, don't eat leaves. They have caterpillars, and the caterpillars will certainly eat their leaves. Could you just describe how they've eaten the leaves, whether they've eaten around the edges or whether there's holes in the middle, and whether the part that's been eaten, is it smooth or jagged?
It's all around the edges, very jagged, sort of bit dead-looking.
Does it look like the sort of feel where the railway station, the ticket man comes along and clicks the ticket? Does it look like that on the edges?
On the edges, yeah. Completely, all the way around.
Right. Okay, that's all right. That's all I needed. It's a matter of, there are certain descriptions, and if I can pick up the description, an accurate description, you can usually hone in on what the problem is. And that one's a weevil problem. There is a garden weevil, and it lives in the soil, and at night time comes up the plant and has a munch, and by the next morning, when it's light, they've disappeared. You don't see them. You never see them. They are very difficult to control. You can use insecticides, a range of insecticides on most insects, and that will bowl them over. Some are perhaps more damaging to the environment than others. But with weevils, there's virtually there's the only really effective chemical, to my knowledge, is Bathroid Advance. It's low toxic. It is toxic, but it's low toxic. And the nice thing about it, in terms of if there are nice things about insecticides, it persists. So the weevils don't come up every night, so they might come up, and if there's Bathroid sprayed over the leaves, it's a contact insecticide, so if they touch it, they get information, they get some toxin, and if they eat it, they also get some toxin. So
yes.
It's just a very effective chemical for controlling very hard to control insects like weevils, and there are some beetles. Right. I think that you'll need them as well. But so Bathroid, I think advance is required, and you put on one application, then watch your new leaves. If the new leaves are not affected, don't spray again, no need to. But if the new leaves are being affected, put on a second spray. And when you're putting on your first spray, be prepared to spray around the base of the plant as well. That's where they hide, and that will help reduce the population.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, because it's one in the whole lot that's like this, and I was concerned about it.
I can imagine. And you look behind the leaves, you look at the leaves and say, there's got to be something there. And you look and you take the leaf off and you look behind the leaf and you look at the plants.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, there are little caterpillars. We'll talk about them later on in another program, but there are minute little caterpillars that produce tiny little holes on the leaves on, say, your wow plants like coleuses and things like that.
Okay.
I'm trying to find out which are the little caterpillars eating my coleus at the moment.
Heather, thanks very much for calling
in. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Same to you. Let's go to Morfitt Vale now. Now, Deborah is on the line with a pomegranate question. Good morning, Deborah.
Good morning. I have several pomegranate trees, and one tree just always has yellow leaves. I don't understand why.
Right. Well, we need a description of the yellowness of the leaves. Is the yellow on the older or younger leaves?
It's on all of them, and some of them have reddishness as well, as if it thinks it's going to sleep again. But it always does that every year.
Yes. Righto. Okay. So is it a bright yellow or a pale yellow?
Probably pale.
Pale. Righto. Yes. That's the next. Then we come down to, is it streaky? Can you actually see the veins? And are the veins green and is yellow in between the veins?
I'll have to go and look.
Well, that's important.
She's on the move, heading out.
We've honed it down to the fact that it's a nutrition issue, and it's then coming down to which issue is it?
So there are kind of reddish veins in it. Yeah, that's right. So that's reddish veins on them?
Reddish
veins. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, you've got a trace element deficiency. If the veins were nice and bright green and yellow in between, that's likely to be an iron deficiency or manganese.
Right.
With the readiness, it worries me a little bit. I think I would be getting probably a good fertiliser, a commercial fertiliser, a granular fertiliser that's for fruit, and make sure it's one that's got a complete range of trace elements.
Okay.
And so you're buying at the top end of that range of fertilisers, and you buy from the better brands, and they'll a fertiliser specifically blended for fruit trees. It'll have the right ratio of the nitrogen, phosphorus and potash, and also it'll have a number of those trace elements. And which trace element, I don't know without looking at a bit more interrogation. I don't think I could drill down onto which one.
Yeah.
But if it's a trace element, that should overcome the problem pretty quickly. And I think putting on an application now, put on another application early in autumn, and maybe then you get onto a regular program of putting on, say, three applications during the growing season until that problem is solved.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thanks for the call, Deborah. Good to hear from you. Love a pomegranate. On the text line, which is 0467922891, Kay is listening to Talkback Gardening while paddling with dolphins at Garden Island.
How about that?
And the photographs are amazing. Says the water is like glass. No mosquitoes. So fortunate having this sanctuary in the city. And Emily in Port Augusta says it's just started bucketing down. So there you go. Hooray, she says, obviously being looked after. We are Talkback Gardening, Deb Tribe and John Lamb. And John, we're talking about agapanthus next. So if it's something that you want to manage, we'll get all of the information from Tracy Coomey.
Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's been a great season for agapanthus. And in many gardens, there's been a magnificent display, often arriving just in time for Christmas. But those flowers are starting to fade, and soon they will produce copious quantities of seed. Now, while many gardeners love their agapanthus, there are those that get very concerned that people shouldn't plant agapanthus because they produce so much seed. And they think that there's a big potential of them becoming feral. And interstate, agapanthus are actually classified as noxious weeds, or as weeds that you're not allowed to grow. So let's take a look at this. The agapanthus farm is run by Tracy and John Coomey, and they're part of the Open Garden Scheme this weekend. So if you want to see an agapanthus or two and want to talk agapanthus, make sure you pop along to the agapanthus farm. But more from that. In fact, why don't we talk to Tracy? Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning, John. How are you?
You have a large number of agapanthus growing at the agapanthus farm. Amaze all our listeners by telling us how many.
Well, I couldn't actually put a figure on it, but it's definitely over 300,000 because we have to deadhead them all.
Oh, Tracy, what happens to them?
It takes us a long time.
Yeah, so obviously there's a big market for agapanthus.
Well, we are certainly increasing, actually, in our sales and even to interstate. And to just talk about what you were saying about the seeds, there are some older varieties of agapanthus that I can understand that people might think that they grow like weeds, but some of the newer varieties are sterile or they set very, very sparse amounts of seed. So if you don't want agapanthus to go nuts in your garden, you can pick one of those varieties.
And
but
that's
the other thing.
May I come in at that particular point?
Sure.
That's particularly important. And people that want to grow agapanthus, buying them from a garden centre, and I checked this out because in the Good Gardening newsletter, we sometimes profile agapanthus. And every time I've done that, I get emails saying you shouldn't talk about agapanthus, they'll set seed. And I went back to the wholesaler, and the wholesaler said, no, John, as a nursery, the nursery industry have agreed they won't sell plants that set seed. They're sterile. So if you buy from a garden centre or you buy from a quality outlet like the agapanthus farm, you can ask for and have sterile plants. But we come back to the fact that there are a lot of varieties out there and people buying old varieties at farmer markets and things like that. And so they're still planting the older varieties. What's the answer, Tracy?
Well, it's an interesting question, John. And we have 60 acres where we are, about 7 acres of intense agapanthus gardens. Now, we never have agapanthus coming up in our paddocks. And in fact, we have 20 different varieties that we sell here. And we don't really get them coming up in each of their little rounds that we plant them in.
Is that because you're mulching? Are you doing something like mulching?
Well, we do mulch, absolutely, but yes. I don't think it's that. I think it's because we do deadhead. So after the flower has gone and you get these little green pods, we deadhead them. We deadhead them down low and we don't have a problem. Now, we also have a terrific answer for all of those deadheads because we have cows and the cows eat them.
So you actually harvest the seeds and then...
We harvest the seeds.
Oh, the whole head. Do you give them the whole heads or just the seeds?
The whole heads and the stalk.
And the cows eat it.
That's running for it.
From a home gardening point of view, I mean, you walk around the streets and many people have got aggies growing out the front of their garden, of their house, and they are starting to fade now and they look pretty miserable because the little seeds are starting to form. You're suggesting that we sort of say, off with their heads.
Off with their heads. And funnily enough, I have clippers in my car, and as I'm going along the streets sometimes I feel very tempted to get out of the car and deadhead agapanthus because they just look so dreadful once they're left.
Yeah.
So I think if they're on the street, and this is something that I think councils perhaps could do as well. I mean, our council, there are agapanthus all along the street, and they very rarely get deadheaded. So I think that's something that people need to do or council need to do if it's on the verge. And then you wouldn't have wild agapanthus growing in other places. But again, we don't get that. So whether it's due to the deadheading or the fact that we do mulch. We use our own compost, but we mulch mainly to reduce the weeds and to reduce having to water.
Well, there's a potential problem out there, and there is a potential solution. And what you're doing, Tracy, is making people aware, don't let your Aggies set seed off with their heads. And before we say thank you, the fact that your garden is open this weekend, Deb, we need some details.
Yes, in fact, Open Gardens SA is up and running again for the year, and your property, Tracy, which is the Littlewood Agapanthus Farm, is open today and tomorrow from 10 until 4:30, and bring cash along if you possibly can. So many agapanthus to see by the sounds of things. So it sounds wonderful. And just to get the address right, that is 69, is it Easley Road?
Easley Road, Littlehampton, yes. Just, it's off Junction Road, mm-hmm. and it's very well signposted. The other thing is we do have FPOS facilities, so that makes it easy for people too.
Great. And just before you leave us, Tracy, Mary from Cuddly Creek says, I'd like to know if we can feed the agapanthus stalks and seeds to sheep too.
I think you can. I'm not an expert in sheep. We don't have them here, but our clients tell us that the sheep will eat them, and alpacas will as well. Now, the other thing about the leaf, for our cows at least, we did have them analysed by APAL, and they are a grade A3 fodder. So you'll find cows leaning through the fence to eat your agapanthus leaves.
How about that?
If they possibly can.
Well, there we are. So don't let your Aggies go to seed. Off with their heads. And if you've got an animal that likes some nutritious food, give them some food. Give them some Aggies.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
Exactly.
Tracy, I never thought the conversation was going to go there, but thank you very much for joining us. And I hope you have loads of people joining you at the Littlewood Agapanthus Farm this weekend for the first open garden of the year, 2024.
Oh, sorry, Deb, I should also say we've got the bonsai people coming as well. So that's another thing that we've got today.
Oh, yes, okay. If you're interested in bonsai, the bonsai people are very good in promoting and giving people information about bonsai. So a good weekend, I think, for you, Tracy. Let's hope it goes well.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tracy. Tracy Coomey from the Littlewood Agapanthus Garden joining us. Thank you to Margie on the text line who asks, what time is Darren Ray on with a new schedule? Well, in a matter of minutes away. So stay tuned for Darren Ray's seasonal outlook for gardeners. But let's go to Pasadena now. And in fact, you can join the queue on 1300 222 891 with your phone calls. Now, Mal, you've got some tomatoes and you'd like to save the seeds. Good morning.
Good morning there, Deb and John. Yes, we bought Roma tomatoes from the garden centre. And a typical garden centre, they don't specify what Roma tomatoes they are. And we ended up with the San Marzano type of the Roma tomatoes. We have had a massive crop off one plant there, probably 3 dozen plus tomatoes, and huge in size. I'm talking about 4.5 inches long and about... in old terms here, about 1.25 inches diameter.
And Mel, what kind of juice have they got inside them?
Oh, well, juice, I would say that they would be ideal for doing...
your sauces and things like that. Yeah, I mean, that's why people buy Romas, or one of the reasons you buy a Roma tomato, because they make great sauce. But anyway, you continue your story.
We've been using them for cooking, and I do like my toast with tomato on in the morning there as well too. So I want to keep those for later on there. So what is the process of saving seeds, please?
Right. Well, pick a nice healthy plant, or you've got a healthy plant. So one branch that is growing and producing nice healthy fruit, I would let the fruit mature. You might put a little protective bag, a little sort of nylon bag or stocking or something like that over it so that it doesn't get eaten by grabs. But the important thing is protect it and allow it to ripen fully on the vine. And you might actually let it get to a bright red, the skin almost sort of starts to wrinkle a little bit. At that stage, you can be guaranteed that the seed inside is mature. If you pick them too early, the seed might be immature and mightn't germinate. So leave it on the vine as long as possible. Once you've picked them, then I would perhaps leave them for a couple of weeks in a cupboard out of the sun, and just let them sort of again mature a little, and then at that stage just stick them in a bowl and get a squashing squashing implement, squash them all up until you've got everything, that the pulp and the seed all mixed up together. Then get a little colander sieve that you use in the kitchen, and you just wash out all the pulp until you've just got the seeds left. At that stage, get some blotting paper or some absorbent paper, put the seeds on the paper, and get them to the stage where they are dry. Not dry, but sort of past damp dry. And again, leave them in the open, out of the sun somewhere, where they're protected, and let them dry out completely. And then at that stage, you just put them in a little paper bag, mark them on, so you put the label on and what you did, and they're ready for planting next season.
Good. Very good there, yeah. No, I don't think I've ever had tomatoes like this. And being a Roma tomato as well, too, they haven't got many seeds in them as well, too. So, yeah.
Mel, I think a lot of gardeners have got to the stage, they said, ho-hum, I can grow tomatoes. I grow great tomatoes, particularly with our current kind of weather we're having this year and last year. Mm-hmm. So people want a little challenge. And so pick out your best tomato and see how you go in collecting the seed and getting it to the stage where you can replant it in the following season. A lot of fun. Thanks, Mel.
We had the opportunity of getting a winter tomato from a garden, local garden centre, and we put that in early August, and we were actually picking tomatoes in October, and they were huge.
Wow.
And very plentiful as well, too. So there is such a thing as a winter tomato.
Yes, and we'll be talking about planting tomatoes in autumn in future programs, but I think this week's program is just a little
chock-a-block.
Overloaded.
It is. And so, Mel, congratulations on that, and please let us know how it goes next year when you do grow them. I'd love to hear from you. We have Talkback Gardening at the moment. Love you to jump on the queue. The phone number to call is 1-300-222-891. John is here to answer your questions all the way through for another hour until 9:30. But coming up next, we are going to be talking to Darren Ray, our independent climatologist, with his seasonal outlook for gardeners.
Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
The surrounding agricultural districts have experienced a relatively mild start to summer. And despite the media releases that are constantly saying we're in for a hot and dry summer because of El Nino, many gardeners are now saying, oh, could it be they've got it wrong? Let's say good morning to our independent climatologist and consulting climatologist here in Adelaide, Darren Ray. Good morning, Darren. Would you care to comment? Have they got it wrong?
Well, I guess the simple answer, John, yeah, good morning, everyone. Good morning. Is there's a lot going on with the climate and then the impacts of us humans on the climate system.
So, obviously, there's more to it than just Adelaide and surrounds too. Presumably, where we're experiencing mild conditions, there's pretty hot conditions and wet conditions in other parts of Australia.
Yeah. Okay, let's break down what's going on. So so we had a few years of La Nina conditions, which tend to result in negative in the ocean dipole influences, which tend to result in wet springs and winds and summers. And then the big thing was we switched to a fairly strong El Nino event through this year, and also the positive Indian dipole influence, which is hotter and drier for Australia typically. And we certainly saw that through spring. So August, September, October in particular was very hot and dry for Australia. Very typical influence in the Indian Ocean. So coming out of spring into summer, the question is, okay, we've got an El Nino around. How hot and dry is it going to get? And normally you expect things to be hotter and drier in El Nino. But we've also had the same time, interestingly, this year, influence from so we've got increase in greenhouse gases, which have got a lot of attention through the year because of climate change, the influence on the heat balance of the atmosphere and impacts on temperatures and that sort of thing. And we've had a very warm year from a climate change perspective from greenhouse gases. But this last couple of months, we've interestingly seen a bit of an influence from another impact of human activity is influence of ozone depletion on and ozone levels in the stratosphere on wind patterns. And so people might remember the there was concern about ozone being depleted in the stratosphere, and that might increase UV levels in the for people and cause cancer and stuff like that. And ozone depletion also impacts the wind patterns. So the changes in the temperature in the stratosphere as the ozone goes is lower, changes the wind patterns in the mid-latitude. So basically what that means, John, is when ozone levels are low, you see more southeasterly winds. So you see the high-pressure system sitting out southwest of WA and east of New Zealand, and we get lots of southeasterlies over southern Australia. And it's a very, very hard one to predict, but actually what we've seen this year, John, is the strong persistent southeasterlies over the last couple of months, which are related to the ozone levels, and that's kept things mild over the southern coasts, while it's been quite warm inland. So we've seen that through November and December.
Yeah, that's particularly important because it's South Australia in particular that's getting the southeasterly winds, whereas inland they're not under influence so much of the southeasterly winds, and of course the eastern states are not getting the southeasterly winds that we're getting. So that explains a lot, and gardeners would sort of say, look, it's been very windy and the winds are from the southeast rather from the northwest.
Yeah. So I remember, it might have been with the last show, the show before, where we had listeners complaining about the strong southeasterlies.
That's right, so, yes.
So for gardeners living in the foothills, what you might expect in southeasterlies is very strong gully winds overnight, which will blow over plants and cause a mess in the garden. And then down for people on the coast, in southeasterlies, you tend to get stronger sea breezes. So so for people in those areas might particularly have noticed that. And if you look at December temperatures, inland the temperatures were about 1.5 to 2.5 degrees above average, but Adelaide were actually about a degree below average.
That's right,
That whole coastal area was of southern South Australia was actually below average because of this effect of the southeasterlies.
Okay, well, look, that's the situation. We've got El Nino there, but it's been given a hard time because of the greenhouse gases, the ocean, the ozone levels, and in particular the effects of the southeasterly winds. Are they going to continue to give El Nino a hard time during January and February?
Yeah, so that's exactly the big question. So the other thing that's going on, John, with southern El Nino mode being positive, with those stronger southeasterlies, what that does is tends to drag down more moisture from the tropics when it's around. So that's why we're seeing above average rainfall in the eastern states in particular, and we've had a little bit of a burst of that. We had a big hit of that in the early part of December as well.
All right.
So there's a lot of things going on opposing the typical El Nino.
Is there ever? So let's take a drill down in January. Here's January. We've started off a little bit of a heat spike at the moment. What can we expect in terms of temperature and rainfall?
So just on that, so it does look like that signal we're seeing with the positive SAM and the southeasterlies is going to persist through January. Probably through, looks like the rest of summer as well in the modelling. So it does look like this pattern will continue to a reasonable degree through the remainder of summer. Now that's great news because it means we've got a lower risk of heat wave than we might have otherwise. The other thing that's going on is we're seeing these bursts of tropical activity going along. And so what that does, when the tropical activity is sitting in particular positions, that can pump up the heat a bit when it's out in the Indian Ocean. When it's over northern Australia, that feeds the moisture over us. And then we've also got these unusually warm oceans around Australia because of climate change opposing the typical El Nino influence as well. So a lot going on. What that means, we've got a bit of tropical activity around at the moment. So we've got some magnitude oscillation activity around northern Australia at the moment, and that's why things are a bit tropical and a bit humid. We're seeing this sort of middle-level cloud that we've woken up to, patchy rainfall, possibility of some thunderstorms, so it's looking like it could get a bit stormy possibly this afternoon and through tomorrow before it clears off. So we've got a bit of a humid, cloudy, possibly stormy sort of feeling weekend of gardening for us the next day or two. Things clear off and get a bit more sort of southeasterly, mid mid-high 20s kind of temperatures through most of the week. And then there's another change coming towards the end of next week, but only a fairly weak one. We go back into southeasterly, so next weekend after this, should be actually pretty pleasant after a change at the end of the week. And then the week after that, more southeasterlies. It looks like another change around about the 19th or 20th, but it looks like it could warm up a bit through the 17th, 18th, 19th of January, ahead of a change around about the 20th. And then getting a bit milder again, and then warming up in the last few days of the month, and possibility of some rain there.
Wow, it sounds like up and down there, Darren.
Yeah.
So what are we looking like for averages in terms of temperature and rainfall for January, above or below?
Well, I mean, looking, as I mentioned, it does look like that sort of positive southeasterly wind influence will continue. So I suspect we'll end up with a situation where Adelaide and the southern parts of South Australia will be near average, maybe probably a little bit milder than average. Whereas inland, it's likely to be quite a bit warmer than average. So I think that does look like that pattern will persist. And so I suspect we'll end up probably a little bit below average with temperatures. So the average for this time of year is 29, but I think we'll see lots of 25s, 26s, 27s, the occasional spike up to 30, 33. We might get a sort of, you know, mid 30s or high 30s, maybe even a day of 40 in there somewhere ahead of a change. But generally overall, it's just a little bit below average. We ran lots of 27, 28 kind of days.
Okay, and I'm just tell you on the text line now, we've got someone saying 30 mils at Streaky in under half an hour yesterday. Greg from Moon to Bay says it's bucketing down hard, 15 mils at the moment. And Brett said 21 mils since 7:25, still pouring at Moon to Bay. So a lot of little patches of rain. How are we going to go with rainfalls for January?
Yeah, and Deb, you've just hit on the trickiness in terms of where the total might end up by the time we get to the end of the month. Really depends whether you happen to get a little bit of some thunderstorm activity come over the top of you or not. And it's really quite patchy, so you know there's big areas, little bits where it might get a few millimetres, and then some places might get a thunderstorm and get, as you mentioned, 30 millimetres or so in a very short period of time. So there is a fair bit of moisture being fed down, but it's still a little bit patchy.
Okay, we're getting to the stage where time is disappearing fast, and I want to zap through. We need to take a look at details of February and March in a fair amount of detail. So take us through with February. Presumably that tropical material at the end of January will sort of move across into the beginning of February.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of a weak sort of tropical activity around about the 28th Jan. Like totals for the month, the modelling's got sort of around about 20 millimetres or so total. But, you know, there's certainly a chance it could get higher than that. The tropical activity does weaken off a little bit in the first week, but picks up again mid-month. And so ahead of that, that's probably, I think, our best chance of getting some more significant heat is in that sort of second week or so up to mid-month of February. Now, it doesn't look super extreme, but, you know, there's sort of possibilities there, but that's really, you know, we could get a sort of prolonged period of sort of days in the sort of low to mid-30s through that sort of weeks 2 and 3 of February. And, you know, there's pretty significant tropical activity kicking off again through that sort of period around mid-February onwards.
So from a gardening point of view, we need to watch out for humidity affecting...
So people noticed it's been really humid. It's very, very humid at the moment. And so that does look like a period where we could have to watch out for possibility of some significant rain and high humidity causing fungal issues, that sort of thing.
All right, and rainfall for February?
Once again, tricky, John. You know, there's some pretty significant tropical activity there. The models have got sort of 20, 30 millimetres, not heaps, a little bit below average, but there is potential there for some significant rainfall.
How about that?
Wow. Okay. And temperatures for February, above or below average, Darren?
Yeah, similar sort of thing. It does look like that positive sun lanyard mode, southeasterly influence will continue, perhaps weakening slightly. So that does, this is where it gets really tricky, is all we need is that to weaken off a little bit, and then we start getting some of those warm temperatures with land. So it does make it a little bit tricky. That period sort of mid-February could get, has some risk of getting fairly hot. So I'm saying, you know, around average, probably a touch below average still for Adelaide, warmer inland. So, yeah, March looks pretty similar. Starting to, you know, the tropical activity starts looking a little bit patchier. But, yeah, once again, so near average temperatures for Adelaide, warmer inland, and rainfall probably a little bit drier in March, because I think tropical activity is going to be a bit sparser and a bit patchy.
What's the likelihood that we're going, I mean, I'm discounting the fact that we're going to have a heat wave in March, but heat spikes, are we going to get heat spikes? And will, say, March be hotter than February, or will February be the hottest month?
I don't think so. I don't think so much. So, you know, we had 2008, we had that big heat wave, but I'm not seeing the sort of influences that line up for that sort of event. This sort of mid 20s, low 30s does look like it'll persist through into autumn. So, you know, it'd be a little bit sort of Indian summerish for well into autumn, but it doesn't look extreme. It's just sort of very, very moderate, reasonably moderate sort of temperatures.
Okay. So could actually February end up being hotter than March?
Yeah, absolutely.
How about that? Okay.
Which is often the case. It's, you know, often that sort of late January, early February period is...
There are many people that like to follow weather systems. They record a lot of information themselves and they talk amongst themselves, and there's a lot of talk going around chatter, I suppose I'd put it, as the fact that maybe El Nino is not going to last as long as they expected and could be replaced fairly quickly by a La Nina, a wetter situation. Would you care to comment on how you see that perspective?
Yeah, so I was looking at the latest modelling and the current ocean temperature patterns, and so last couple of months I've been noticing a little bit of cooling off the coast of Chile, and that is a little bit of a signal that there's some cool water making its way up towards the equator, which could set up a La Niña event, and so I've been seeing that and thinking, oh yeah, that's 50 feet, and statistically 50% of the time after an El Niño event is a La Niña year. So statistically the chances of getting La Niña following in the spring and winter, summer following El Niño are pretty good. And then I was looking at the latest ocean modelling, and there's a very rapid transition in the modelling through winter into a La Niña event in the modelling through the next few months. So, we're certainly seeing this sort of possibility that we could transition back into a La Niña event and a pretty early one, potentially, developing during winter.
And bearing in mind, you heard the technical side of this on Talkback Gardening from Darren Ray. Darren, we'll follow that one very, very closely. Value very much your comments, and you can go by the models, and the models have been saying one thing, but your ability to be able to look at how the model then sort of relates to South Australia and how the weather factors, weather patterns come together, and South Australia and the effect on South Australia can be so different to other parts of Australia. That's invaluable, and it's Butte that it's only available, it's a pity, it's only available on ABC Talkback Gardening, on Saturday Talkback Gardening. And I'm proud of the fact that you're part of the program, Darren, and I value that very much.
Yeah, thanks, John. It's nice to be able to provide a bit more detailed insight into what's going on and what's a tricky year. And and it's going to be an interesting year, you know, from the broader climate change perspective, to see what comes out. There's been some big news last year about, you know, carbon emission budgets, and, you know, we're starting to run out of time. We're going to need to get our act into gear pretty quickly. Some major work come out on that, highlighting the urgency around this. There's some potentially big impacts there for people growing crops and gardening. So, it's good to be able to share some insight. I hope everyone enjoys the rest of summer.
Thank you, Darren, and we really thank you for joining us. Just Sue quickly asks, when is the opening rain coming for the farmers? Any ideas?
Excellent question. So digging into modelling, mid-April's looking, so a little bit early, is looking on the cards. It's really strong. So looking at the modelling yesterday ahead of the show, there's a pretty strong signal of increase in rainfall mid-April. So, something to watch out for in the next few months.
What about hail, says this listener?
Oh, come on.
Too hard to predict. But it's
a bit tricky, right? I mean, always a possibility with this patchy thunderstorm activity we've got around.
Yeah. And look, on that, Sue from Henley Beach raises the fact that a lot of the different weather forecasts are varying. Roger says, there are so many wrong forecasts being made. And Dave says, I've heard that the current weather models aren't working with climate change because it's accelerating. So I guess we are living in difficult times in terms of being able to accurately predict what's going to happen.
Rather make a comment on that, I just would like a comment myself. If you actually follow what Darren is saying in terms of the changes, and it's what's happening at the beginning or the middle or the end of the month, if you take a look at what he's saying and write that down, you'll find he's incredibly accurate and on those particular systems. Okay, he has to rely on the models for the overall picture and go along with what the models are saying, but his ability to be able to break it down to South Australia and to the parts of the month, I think, is incredibly brilliant of you, Darren, and full marks.
Thanks, Darren, thanks, John. And happy new year to you as well.
Yeah, just very, very quickly on that. I guess the thing is there are a lot of things going on, and I mean it's a pretty good question about have we actually captured some stuff that we weren't quite expecting, and even stuff like changes in rules around shipping fuel has caused impacts on aerosol production, which impacts ocean temperatures, and so there's a lot of things going on. We've got ozone depletion, and so all the things we're doing do have an impact, and so it's good to think for us to bear that in mind.
Darren Ray, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Deb. Thanks, John.
Catch you February.
Yes, excellent.
Thank you. Our consulting climatologist, Darren Ray. Coming back to your calls next, 1300 222 891 is the number to call to speak directly to John.
This is Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
We are Talkback Gardening. The number is 1300 222 891. Lorna from Paringa has called it. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning.
Now, you have got some powdery mildew happening on your agapanthus.
Yes, and just can't get rid of it.
Can you move the agapanthus so that they sit in full sun? I presume they're in a fair amount of shade.
No. There are. We've got hundreds of them, and they're up and down our four driveways.
Oh, okay. So there's a big problem there. I think the most effective and probably the most cost-effective method, ecofungicide is very, very effective. It's one of the new age chemicals.
I think we've already tried that.
Ecofungicide?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So if you've tried that on a few plants and it keeps on coming back. It's all to do, I mean, it's perfect weather for a powdery mildew. Powdery mildew is not a wet season fungus. It works in high humidity, particularly in cloudy weather and where the temperatures are relatively warm to mild. And so we're getting ideal powdery mildew weather. Rather than if you've tried the ecofungicide, and it's not the cheapest, so try wettable sulfur. Wettable sulfur is extremely effective on powdery mildew. The important factor is don't spray when the temperatures on the day that you spray are going to be above 32 degrees.
No.
But if you spray today and tomorrow it's going to be 42 degrees, that's still okay. But wettable sulfur, I think you'll find, if anything's going to control it, that will. So give it a good thorough spray, watch it, and when you can see that it's likely to reappear, put on a second application before it starts to really spread across the plants. And getting it in its early stage of reproduction is probably very important.
Yes, I know. One year we didn't get any flowers on them.
Oh, dear. And from that many?
Yeah.
All right, well, good luck with it this year, Lorna.
Okay, thank you. Well, I do go around and cut all the tops off.
Yes, as per Tracy's advice, do all the deadheading.
Yeah, all the deadheading.
And I guess you don't have any llamas to feed it to.
No, I wondered if I could give them to the chooks.
Well, there we are. I'll stay out of this one.
Yeah, we're not sure on that one, Lorna, so you may need some advice, but thank you very much for calling in. Cameron is in Port Lincoln. Cameron, you've had a bit of rain in the last 24 hours, I hear.
Yeah, we had 22 mil yesterday, and it's starting to rain again now.
Gee, okay. Now, you've got a pink lady apple tree. What's the problem with it?
I don't know if it's much of a problem, but it's half of it's full of fruit, and the other half has it's all full of flower still. And I was wondering, will those flowers turn into fruit eventually? Is it just too late in the season? They'll just drop off and...
I suspect that they'll form fruit. Some of them might form fruit, but they'll be small fruit. And whether they get to maturity, I very much doubt it. Flowering is induced by temperatures and day length. And so you'll find that in springtime, when the temperatures get to a certain level and there's a certain amount of sunlight, that's the trigger for the hormones to sort of be released and allow the plant to flower. Now, there'll be dormant flowers, or there'll be buds there with dormant flowers in them. And as we go through the season, at the beginning of the season, or early in spring, you'll get sort of mild temperatures and certain lengths of day. And that's repeated in autumn. And often you'll find that you'll find plants which flower in spring also spot flower in that autumn period when you're getting similar temperatures and day length. That, I think, is the way I'd explain it. But in terms of answering your question, it's just a phenomena. Watch it. You may see that it's got fruit on it. Make sure that those fruits don't get spiked by codlin moth, otherwise you'll aggravate your codlin moth problem. I would be very surprised if they come to maturity.
Oh, Cameron, sorry to hear about that. Thank you very much for the call, though. The number is 1300 222 891. Also giving away 3 ABC Organic Gardener magazines after 9 o'clock. Now, John, next week we're going to catch up with Joe Kilinowski. Is that right?
Yes. Figs. There's a question. There are many people coming in with their problems with figs, and there was a big problem earlier on with the fact that there were lots of figs, but they were small, and the question was, will they ripen? Joe Kalinowski from the Joint Gardens, he'll be sort of our guest next Saturday talking figs. It's a mild start to summer, but we're going to have more hot weather coming during January and February. And so I think it's important that you take a look at your irrigation system. And next week, our guest will be a specialist on irrigation. Richard Wilson will be our guest next week. And so until then, good gardening.